Okay. All right. Well, welcome everyone to A Life in Biography, to my podcast. I'm speaking today with Robert Hamlin, a friend who goes back a long, long ways. We're going to be talking about his book, Plutarch Redux, Parallel Poems in the Age of Trump. But before we talk specifically about that book, Bob, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing in your long life.
Well, like you, I've spent a lot of time with that writer, William Faulkner. I suppose most people might know of my work through Faulkner studies. But I also write a good bit of poetry. I've even lately been trying to write some fiction, stories and novellas. And that's been a lot of fun. I've done a good bit of that in my retirement. I taught at Southeast Missouri State University for 50 years, retired in 2015. And of course, with the pandemic, I've had a lot of time on my hands, and I've been doing a lot of writing, including the Plutarch book.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of this book? I noticed that you dedicated it to Jay Martin, who's also going to be a guest on this podcast.
Jay Martin and I have been friends for a long time, ever since I studied with him at Irvine in 1977. I went out there and participated in his NEH seminar on Revolutionary War literature. And we've been friends ever since. He reads what I write, and I read what he writes. It's been a long-range friendship. We haven't seen each other very many times in all those years, but we've stayed in touch with email and telephone, and it's been a good friendship. I got an email from him, and he suggested that I should read Shakespeare's Coriolanus as a commentary on the Trump presidency. And I didn't remember whether I'd ever read Coriolanus or not, but I went back and looked at it, and I was amazed at the parallels between the Shakespeare's play and the Plutarch and the Trump administration. So I wrote a poem about that. I sent it to Jay, and he liked the poem, and he said, you should write more poems about paralleling the Plutarch lives with contemporary politicians. And I thought that was an intriguing idea, so I dug out my old copy of Plutarch and started rereading, and I was amazed at the parallels I found. I suppose politicians are similar, whatever era they live in. So I started writing the poems, and I would send them as I wrote them. I sent them to Jay. He's a classical scholar, among other things. And he would look at them, and he would often make suggestions about other Plutarch characters that I could use. And so it was a kind of a teamed effort there as we exchanged the poems, and that's why I dedicated the book to him, of course, because he was instrumental in my writing it.
Well, I have to say, I have a special interest not only in your Plutarch book as a biographer, but I have a special interest in Jay Martin. My connection with Jay Martin goes back to the 1980s. When I was writing a biography of Lillian Hellman, who was a friend of Nathaniel West. And of course, Jay wrote a biography of Nathaniel West. Jay is not only a biographer, he's a psychoanalyst, and as you know, lots more. So I was interested in his picking on Coriolanus. That, in fact, is my favorite Shakespeare play because it has such penetrating both psychological and political insight. Plutarch gets him started, but once Shakespeare reads Plutarch and he begins to look at Coriolanus's relationship with his mother, for example. It seems so modern, almost Freudian in a way, don't you think?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And that was true of so many of the characters I looked at. Of course, some of the Plutarch Lives have multiple reincarnations among contemporary politicians. I think for most of the poems, readers will be able to identify the contemporary figure that I have in mind. But for some of them, you could pick three or four different senators or representatives to fit that description. So, yes, it was just marvelous getting into all that material and seeing the parallels.
Oh, I think so. Would you mind reading from the prologue? It's relatively short, so I think we can do the whole thing if you wish.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I thought I should give Plutarch voice in the book. In fact, I let him speak the prologue, and then the concluding sentence of the book is also by Plutarch. Here is my prologue. I'm extremely pleased that my book of the lives of notable Greeks and Romans is being consulted and analyzed nearly two millennia after I wrote it. Any writer would be happy that his work is read even a generation after his death. For it to be read and considered relevant for hundreds and hundreds of years is remarkable, and if I might be allowed a bit of vanity, quite flattering. In one regard, however, I must say that such a development is not totally surprising if one really thinks about it. Nature has produced billions of human beings over the centuries, but the molds which she uses to generate them are not nearly so numerous. In fact, they are actually quite limited. As a result, the same character types are replicated over and over again. Governments, laws, fashions, manners, language change over time, but human nature apparently doesn't. The heroes and villains in my day are not inherently different from the heroes and villains in yours. The only real distinction is that we killed more politicians than you do. You re-elect yours and give them golden parachutes when they retire. I hope you enjoy this little book. May it encourage you to be vigilant and wise in your choice of political leaders. It's signed Lucius Mestrius Plutarchus.
I love it. It has that kind of measured Plutarchian tone, you know, a kind of not exactly removed, but certainly a kind of objectified sense that you're not just looking at individual lives, but you are looking in a sense at molds or templates. I think it's really, it fascinates me that we can use Plutarch this way, that he does illuminate the present. And I can imagine him making the kind of comment that you have him making on the present. I think it's also, as biographers, and you've written biographies, by the way, a very fine short biography of William Faulkner, but that's not the only biography you've written. To some extent, biography is a kind of impersonation. You have to, as far as you can, get inside the skin of your subject. And I think that's what you're doing with Plutarch as well.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I know we have different views in our time of biography, somewhat different from his. I treat that a little bit in the poem I addressed to him. I think biographers in our time, you among others, we might put more emphasis on the context, the environment, the culture that produces a life. I state in the Plutarch poem that is character, individuals who determine history, but I, I think we have a more balanced view of that in our time, and I think we do realize that individuals are a part of a circumstance, and certainly those things have influence. With regard to Faulkner, the writer we know so well, Faulkner was a modernist, and certainly the culture and principles of modernism influence him heavily. But still, it's the individual writer, Faulkner, who uses that material and shapes it for his own purposes. So while we might have a little better understanding or recognition of the context of a life, I still think we agree with Plutarch that it is largely the individual life and not the circumstances that direct human history.
Yeah, but certainly as a biographer, I feel that I have that conviction. I feel that very firmly. Why don't you read the Plutarch poem?
Yes, Plutarch. It is character that determines destiny, not fortune or broad historical movements or abstract principles, but individual men and women, great or common, and the choices they make for good or evil. Know that there is no beast more savage than man when possessed of power added to rage. Guard against such. Know, too, that service must never be for self, but for country. Read these lives and take heed.
Wonderful. It's it gets at the moral power of Plutarch's biographies as well, that there's a sense of a meaning in history that one must read. And if one doesn't read that meaning, you're proceeding ahead at your own peril. I feel the same way about your Coriolanus poem. Let's read that Coriolanus poem too.
Yes, thank you. Somebody should write a play about a politician whose monomaniacal ego, uncontrollable ambition, self-serving lies and boastings, and refusal to compromise or admit mistake lead to class conflict, conspiracy theories, sedition, insurrection, and ruin to self and others. You might include these lines, quote, which will in time break ope the locks of the Senate and bring in the crows to peck the eagles, end quote. You could also consider casting a doting mother who persuades our protagonist not to avenge himself on his enemies and allies alike, even his own country, but that would doubtless prove too sentimental and old-fashioned for a modern audience. Someone has already written such a play, you say?
The ending is just slays me. It's so witty, so marvelous. I hope people just read these poems. I'm not going to try to belabor them with interpretation. You can read all, as you said, there are all kinds of examples. It's the age of Trump. It's not just Trump. It's the whole nature of politics that Plutarch and through Plutarch Shakespeare gets at as well. And I think that's the coverage that we're getting in the poems that you're writing in this book.
Well, I appreciate the invitation to read a few of them. Let me start with a couple that sort of set the political context.
Sure.
This book is slanted. There's no doubt about it. But every now and then in a poem, I'll try to play a more balanced hand, and it is partly about the overall situation today of politics, and so. I'll read a couple that don't have individual applications, but I think they set the tone or tenor for the politics that we're having to live with today. I'm sure most people know about Aesop's fables, and one of those is a fable of the shepherds and the wolves. And the wolves come up on the shepherds who are eating sheep. And the wolf says, of course, to the shepherd, "If I were doing that, you'd be very upset about it." And so I took Aesop's fable of the shepherd and the wolves, and I applied it to the two principal political parties. And this is that poem. The donkey says to the elephant, "What an uproar you would make if I were doing that." The elephant says to the donkey, "What an uproar you would make if I were doing that." And both continue devouring the sheep. Mm. And then another one, I think, deals with the general situation. Alcibiades was a shrewd politician who tended to change sides when it was politically expedient. And so here is my Alcibiades poem. How to stay alive and remain in office. Always check to see which way the wind blows. Allegiances are negotiable. Master the art of delay and obstruction. Wear your enemies out with waiting. Treat principles like a dirty shirt. Change often. Never collaborate. Limit opponents to one term. Follow the money. The poor have nothing to give. Suck up to power. You might need a pardon someday. Practice the filibuster. It leaves no fingerprints. If all that fails, do as I did. Leave the country.
That's fabulous. History with a sense of humor, or maybe biography with a sense of humor. I'm not sure, or maybe both. There's one poem of yours that, if you don't mind, it's a little presumptuous of me to read your poetry, but there's one poem, which I will mention in a moment, which gets at, to me, both the nature of Plutarch and the nature of poetry as opposed to, journalism, for example, and what we can know about somebody. This is a poem which, it seems to me, raises that issue of identity in a way that is beyond the compass of something like journalism, or maybe in a sense of biography, because it's really going into the core of a character. So if you don't mind, I'm going to read this poem.
Please do.
Okay. It's called Electra. The whole world wonders about my relationship with my father. And sometimes I do as well. Daddy's girl, people call me. And even Daddy says he would like to have sex with me if I weren't his daughter. It's being said that even he told two of his lovers they reminded him of me. Then there are all those photos of him kissing or groping me. I joke about all those things, and I would never express my disappointment to Daddy, but his words and behavior trouble me. I try to forget it all by obsessing over business and clothes and jewelry, but I can't. There are times when I think I could kill for him, and there are other times when I want to kill him. I would never say any of this to a living person, but since you and I and so many of us now inhabit a hell we can never escape, I know my secrets are safe from the world. Wow, Bob, that's just really... I don't know what to say. It's so penetrating. We don't know whether this Electra is actually thinking things, but it's a way of in a sense, empathizing with her in a way that you wouldn't get in the public prints, you know, in news reports or even in a biography, don't you think?
I think so. I think biographers and hopefully poets, we are privileged to go places and explore thoughts and motives in a way that journalists or maybe other writers cannot. And of course, poets have an out. It's fiction anyway. So we can pretty much say whatever we choose to say. If we're faulted for it, we'll just say, well, it was fiction. I was trying in the poems to get at some truths or recognitions that maybe, we don't always get on CNN. And of course, in the poem you just read, I had to draw upon Dante and, those consigned to hell. They wouldn't be telling their stories if they knew the listener was going back to the real world. So they can say their innermost thoughts and secrets. And it is fascinating. You would know this better than I, as one who's done so many biographies. It is fascinating to try sometimes to get within the head, the mind, the thought process of public figures, well-known writers or movie stars. We see most of the time their surface lives. And it's fascinating to try sometimes to wonder what's going on in the inner life, inside their head, their emotions. And I was trying to get at a little bit of that in that poem, I think.
Well, you know what I can see a biographer doing with a poem like yours is it gives you, in a sense, leads. Things to think about, evidence to look for, a way of reading the public character that the biographer might not otherwise do. I was thinking, for example, of Joyce Carol Oates' novel Blonde, which is based on Marilyn Monroe's life. She has a depiction of the blondes of Marilyn Monroe's childhood in her book that is just scarifying. It's just so traumatic. It made me as a biographer even understand a little more deeply those stories that, of course, I know as a biographer of Marilyn Monroe, but am not permitted in quite the same way as Oates does to evoke what it is. Now, the other thing about this poem, Electra, that in fact only occurred to me, maybe it occurred to me before, but I don't remember that it did, but it did while I was reading Electra this time, when she says, "Daddy," I thought about Sylvia Plath's poem, Daddy.
Yes, yes.
And you start out the book by talking about there are these molds, these shapes that people fit in. It's not that we're all alike. It's not exactly that history repeats itself, but there is a paradigm that Plutarch caught onto very early that we are still playing out and also trying to understand. And I think your poems are really getting at that.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me share another one with you that
sure.
sets up a general context. We live in the world of social media, and I had a little fun playing with that in Odysseus. The character from the Trojan War, of course. And I play with fiction again. I imagine what the world would have been like for him and his era if they had some of the technology that we have today. So here's a little different take on the Trojan War from a modern political perspective. Odysseus. Had we the internet and social media, we wouldn't have needed the horse. In fact, we wouldn't have needed to go to war at all. We could have flooded computer screens with misinformation and conspiracy theories, interfering in elections and affairs of state, sowing deceit and mistrust among all parties. We could have persuaded Paris that Helen was a plant, an undercover agent sent to Troy to steal top secrets. Politicians and the NRA are always susceptible to beautiful spies, and Paris is no exception. He would have given away the nuclear codes the first night. No need to launch 1,000 ships. Just ship out 1,000 lies. Once exposed, Helen would have been sent home on the next boat out. You can read the whole story on WikiLeaks.
Marvelous. Yeah. It's all there. It's history, but it's also in a way current events, as you say, parallel poems in the age of Trump. It's all there.
Let me share with you now a couple that do have very specific and recognizable individual parallels. This is my Antigone. Ancient Antigone moves among us, speaking truth to power, and better, truth to herself. Beautiful, self-possessed, serenely secure in her person and her position. Some would disqualify her on the basis of her youth or gender. Others would prefer the fake news of Creon, voice of the establishment, demanding adherence to the middle road of practicality and social order. But you, Antigone, know better. Stay true to principle. Trust the pleas you heard when you tended bar. Shake the trees of justice so that the ripe fruit may fall to all. We do not need a Tiresias to require a crucifixion in order to know right from wrong. Rewrite history. Let our Antigones live and learn from them. And Spartacus. Only in the movies do we love you, Spartacus. In the real world, we still lock you in cages, brutalize your hopes for freedom and equality, feed you to the lions. Yes, we'll use your athletic prowess as a Mermillo to turn the wheels of capitalism, but expect our cheers to become jeers and sneers if you dare to claim your manhood by stepping outside the lines. How long has it been since you ask, can't we all just get along? But still the knees close off your breath and kill the dream. Stand up and salute the flag, they tell you. And you say you will when they quit using it as a shroud for their hatred. Rise up, O warrior, brave and strong. Bring to the battle the spirit of Douglas, Tubman, Wells, King, Malcolm X, Mandela, and Abrams. Make of your long-voiced cry a demand no longer to be deferred. This is the day we shall overcome. And there's one to the police. Leonidas, who was the general who gave his life to save his comrades. Leonidas. Let it be known and never forgotten that on this day, a small band of patriots stood tall against the advancing horde of barbarians who stormed the city. Outnumbered, and betrayed by fellow citizens who assisted the invaders, but finding courage superior to numbers, they held the doors, saving the Republic. Go tell the nation, stranger passing by, that here, obedient to the Constitution, they stood. That last stanza, by the way, is a paraphrase of a monument that stands on the location of the battle where Leonidas gave his life.
Oh. It's very moving. Your poetry reminds me a great deal of some of the poets that I admire so much. I guess you could call them historical poets, poets who deal with history, like Konstantin Kavafy, for example, a Greek poet, or Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet, or one who's not nearly as well known, an Irish poet, Sheila Wingfield. It seems to me you're in that group.
Well, that's quite a compliment. You named some very fine poets there. I don't think I belong in that group, but I appreciate the connection.
It is a connection, whatever one makes of your poems. I think the connection there is very strong. Did you have any poets in mind, you know, other than obviously Plutarch? But I mean, were there other poets that you were thinking of, or you think you draw on?
I don't think so, specifically. There are allusions to various poets. Because of all my work with Faulkner, people are surprised that Faulkner is, sometimes they're surprised that Faulkner is not my favorite writer. I do incline to the poets. Robert Frost is my favorite poet.
Yes.
Emily Dickinson would be a close second. And of course, we all love and reread and admire Shakespeare's sonnets. I tend to favor the poets rather than fictionists. But I don't think I had any one particular one in mind for this book. They came out of the link to Plutarch.
Sure.
I'm not a traditional poet, of course, and I like contemporary poets who speak in more of a conversational style. Maybe a good love poem maybe should rhyme. I'm not much interested in traditional verse form, and I do try to just speak in a conversational, even casual style. And so poets who incline in that direction are the ones, I suppose, that have influenced me the most. One thing I was particularly fascinated by in this book was the transition of power. As a democracy, we pride ourselves on being different from so much of history and so much of the rest of the world, in that we do encourage a peaceful transition, a transfer of power. And one of my favorite poems in the book, Demetrius, addresses that. Demetrius was replaced as king. He had to step aside and let someone else ascend to the throne. And he gives us an example of the way that transition should take place. So many times it's a result of coup or violence, revolution, insurrection. But we've always thought that we favored a more peaceful transfer of power, and that's being called into question these days. And we're not sure just what the future will hold in that regard. Here's Demetrius. How, when the people have chosen another, do you leave the highest office in the land? With pomp and circumstance? In a huge parade with a 21-gun salute? You dressed in a golden robe and purple shoes, riding in a chariot drawn by four white horses, your vassals striding in escort, your children weeping at your side. More noble to go like King Demetrius, quietly laying aside his royal garment, putting on a simple cloak, and leaving unseen by the stage door, an actor, knowing this play is over. Time to look for another role. We wish, we wish.
Yeah, it does sort of remind me though of George Bush leaving the presidency, not quite that quietly, no president does, but he did go off and paint.
Yes, yes indeed.
And I think that's very telling. I think that's a very interesting example of what you can do after the days of power are over. It puts it in context. It as great as it might be to be Ozymandias or whoever you are, time has a way of not erasing it, but certainly crumbling it in a way. And to go to painting, of all things, go to art. I think I was not fond of George Bush as a president, but I have to say that is very impressive.
Yes, indeed, and the way I love those images we see from time to time. At least we used to see them. You'd see Bush and Carter and Clinton. The elderly Bush as well, you'd see them joining forces, cooperating, working together on various projects post-presidency. What a contrast, yeah, to what we have today. It's so sad. It's really so sad, but this book is not altogether pessimistic. I like most Americans, I think I have faith and hope in our system. I think we'll right the ship. We'll get back to true principles, and so if you'll allow, I'll read a couple of the poems that I think that are not so pessimistic, not so cynical. I think they do express what I think is the majority American view about history and the future. And I think we will get back to our better angels, as it has been called. This one is Claudius. Early on, a stutterer with a limp and a lisp, you learned how to survive. Don't make waves, stay out of sight of the bullies and rivals who would oppose any chance you might have to ascend to the throne, even destroy you if necessary. Hide ambition under a love of books. Let them think you lazy and inept. Adopt a see nothing, know nothing, go along to get along actor's pose. Lunch with the plebeians, associate with freedmen, hold disloyal aristocrats at a distance. Bide your time. But now the madman is gone. Brought down by his own stupidity, hubris, and greed, and you become the head of state. What a Humpty Dumpty world you've inherited. Divided government, plague sweeping the planet, economy in free fall, infrastructure in rot and disrepair, threats from foreign foes. And you know your enemies will continue to obstruct your efforts by railing at your past mistakes, personal biases, and verbal gaffes. Will the madness be prolonged, or will you and we prevail? The latter, you believe, because we share together hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. And we have a history of overcoming, owning the finish line. And one more that I think expresses the American ideal. Pericles was known as a great orator, and we had one of those recently in the White House. Pericles. More than politician, noble statesman, believer in the better angels of our nature, you tell us to go high, not low, in our actions and expectations. You tell us to honor our soldiers, those whose heroism and sacrifice make possible our freedom, peace, and prosperity. You tell us to cherish democracy, to value the political process that gives voice to each and all in the decisions that affect our lives. You tell us to respect our neighbors, to treat them as equals of ourselves, no matter their economic or social rank or personal circumstances. You tell us to promote justice for all, equal opportunity under the law, regardless of religion, gender, race, or ethnicity. You tell us, once strangers ourselves, to welcome and treasure our immigrants, not view them as unworthy foreigners and lock them in cages. You tell us there is no liberal America or conservative America or white or black or Latino or Asian America. There's only the United States of America.
Well, I think we're approaching the finish line of the podcast. That's a good way to end it. I just wanted to say that you said you're not a traditional poet, and you're certainly not aiming at rhyme or conventional kinds of verse form, but your poetry certainly has a cadence to it. It has a what I'd call a cadence and a character to it, and a location of the right words, which is part of what's going to get us out of this. I think that's why Lincoln is such an important president, and why Obama at certain times was an important president, because of this gift of language. And that association, I think, of art and politics is an important one to remember. I'm also thinking that you said Frost was your favorite writer. Frost is certainly one of my favorite writers, maybe second to Faulkner. They're very close. And there are moments in Frost's poetry in which you just sort of feel, well, he's just nailed it. I mean, there are phrases, there's a cadence there that you can't let go of, you know. So dawn goes down today.
Yes.
Nothing gold can stay.
Yes.
Who can beat that?
Right. You know, I have people who tell me, and I take it as a compliment. I'm glad to hear it. They tell me that they like to hear me read the poems more than they enjoy them on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ties in with what you're saying. You know, poetry originally was an oral tradition.
Yes.
The early bards and minstrels. And so I think that's I listen to that even in the non-traditional poetry that I admire. I listen for those cadences too. I listen to how the words sound more than just how they appear on the page. And I'm very grateful and rewarded when people tell me that they prefer to hear the poems more than just read them.
Yeah, I could see that. But where can people get your book?
Well, since I've retired, Carl, I've been self-publishing. I think the last 8 books I have done, I have self-published. I'm at my age, I'm no longer interested in long-range projects. And as you know, academic presses can take quite a while to make a book.
Yes.
And since I'm retired, I don't have to worry about peer reviews. And so I've been self-publishing. And the only problem with self-publishing is the marketing aspect of it.
That's right.
You know, and it's there's a kind of a conspiracy, I think, between publishers and chain bookstores. Most of the chains will not carry self-published books.
That's right. Yes, I've done some self-publishing as well, and that's certainly the obstacle you face.
But I self-publish on Amazon and through Amazon, and the books are available there. But I had a good day job. I have a good retirement. I'm not really interested in marketing books. I'm always pleased when somebody wants one of them. But I probably give away more books now than I sell, and that's fine. That's fine. Again, Freneau told us a long time ago that writers should hitch their writing to another profession, you know, and,
yes.
And for many of us, that's been teaching. I didn't ever start, except for the academic work, the scholarly work, the fiction, the poetry that I never started out to publish any of that. I wrote for myself, self-expression is sort of like keeping a journal, a diary. And then lo and behold, at some point I realized you got quite a few poems here, you know?
Yes.
And so I've had 2 or 3 books published by commercial presses, the poems, but these days I self-publish and don't really work at marketing the book, but they're out there and people can find them on Amazon if they're interested in them.
That's terrific. Yeah. I've had the same experience. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you, Bob. I'm glad you had a chance to read so many of your poems.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to visit with you. We do go way back, as you said, been friends for quite a while. You were one of your essay on Faulkner and Time was one of the earliest influences in my study of Faulkner. And I guess we've traveled some parallel roads in that regard.
Oh, I think so.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. You keep writing as well.
I will. Can't seem to stop. And I'm going to post this interview that we've had on Facebook and Twitter. I'm going to send you a link so you can broadcast it to the world.
Thank you very much. You have a good day.
Thanks, Bob. Bye-bye.